Okay, Erev Tov, everybody. A pleasure to see everybody, and a pleasure to welcome back Rabbi Dr. Benjamin Samuels, Benji, if I may say that. He served as the rabbi of Congregation Shari Tefila in Newton already 27 years. Am I correct in that?
By 28 year, correct.
28 year, very nice, very nice. And I got smich at YU, a PhD in science, philosophy, and religion from Boston University, a master's in biblical studies, and it's really a pleasure to welcome back to give another shir for our ongoing partial shir. Bakasha.
Thank you, Rav J. And I will begin by just thanking Rav J. for this opportunity and expressing my ongoing admiration for this incredible machine of Harbatzis Torah that he created called Torah in Motion. And I'm glad to see that the Zoom education continues even as we emerge out of this shared pandemic these past couple of years. It is wonderful to be with all of you this evening. I see some near and dear friends, there are other names that I don't know. Some of this class, of course, is frontal, and we ask people to stay muted while we're in more presentation mode. But I do encourage people to ask and answer questions, especially when I ask for answers to questions or insights. And, you could raise your virtual hand, or you could just unmute and interrupt as appropriate. If you're willing to share your screen, it makes for a better experience for all, but we understand that people need their privacy or might be multitasking. So whatever works for you, we thank you for making time for Torah on this Thursday night, Erev Shabbos. Okay. I am going to move. I have a wealth of screens in front of me, three screens. So I'm going to move you to my left screen because I'm going to share the screen. And so if you see me looking to the left, it's only because I'm looking at your beautiful faces and your names. I'm not watching Netflix or looking at something else. I'm here to study Torah with you. Okay, my dear friends, this week for the Parshat HaShavua, we study Parshat Mishpatim. And as we know, for the most part, Parshat Mishpatim is the civil corpus of law. Now, yes, it has some criminal law, it has some ritual religious law, but it is famous for its civil law. But we could combine them all together because they're all of one body of law, right? When we think of the Mishnah, the repository of Jewish law with its six siddarim, it has religious law and civil law and criminal law and festival law and agricultural law and sacrificial law and purity law. It has it all bound up together. And so the same we get in Parshat Mishpatim. But what I'm interested in is not the categories of law and their relationship between them, although that is important. I'm interested in something else that I'd like to bring to your attention, and that is the relationship between what is famously known as nomos and narrative, based on a wonderful article of that title that appeared in, I believe, the Yale Law Review or the Harvard Law Review a few decades back. But nomos means law and narrative. What is the relationship between the two? And I hope to highlight that for you today and point to a very interesting aspect of our parsha to demonstrate this. So, but to start with, I want to go back to the very beginning. And so I'm going to share the screen, and hopefully it is large enough. And we are going to look at the very beginning of Sefer Bereshit. So Sefer Bereshit begins, Bereshit bara Elokim et hashamayim ve'et ha'aretz. In the beginning, God created the heavens and earth, or when God began to create the heavens and the earth, we know that could be parsed in different ways. But I want to draw our attention to one of the most famous Rashis to remember. So what does Rashi say? Rashi quotes Rabbi Yitzchak, and it's not his father. Rashi's known as Rabbi Shlomo Yitzchaki, but it's the Tana Rabbi Yitzchak, Amar Rabbi Yitzchak, Lo haya tzarich lahatchil et haTorah ela me'achodesh hazalachem. Shehi mitzvah rishona shenitzdavu Yisrael. Rabbi Yitzchak asks a question. Why does the Torah begin with creation? We could expand that. Why does the Torah begin with creation and continue with the foundations of society and then give us the patriarchal and matriarchal narratives of our avos and imahos? Why does it begin with narrative? Why doesn't it begin with Exodus chapter 12? Why Exodus chapter 12? Because that's where the children of Israel as a people received their first mitzvah. Umatam patach bebreshit. Why did the Torah begin with the creation of the universe, the parasha of Breshit? And we could expand that and even say the whole sefer of Breshit. Why present this narrative? Why interrupt law with narrative? If the Torah is, as its name indicates, a book of instruction, right? The shoresh of the Hebrew word Torah is the equivalent of what we would say in English, instruction. If it is a book of commandments, a book of law, why interrupt law with narrative? Just start with the first law. Start with HaChodesh HaZalachem. That's Rashi's question. Now, Rashi provides an answer, and that's worthy of study, but we're not going to study the answer. I'm interested in the question. Why interrupt law with narrative? Now, I would like to shift our focus now to Sefer Shemot. And here you could see, right, the pasuk in question that Rabbi Yitzchak quotes. HaChodesh hazelachem rosh chodashim rishon hu lachem l'chodshei hashana. The mitzvah of the creation of the Jewish calendar. Now, you might say, but that's not exactly clear. It doesn't say, and thou shalt create a Jewish calendar. But even if you trip up on HaChodesh hazelachem, you keep going through the rest of Perek Yudbet. The rest of Perek Yudbet are the laws of the Korban Pesach, the sacrificial offering, and other laws attendant to that day and future observances of Chag HaMatzot and Chag HaPesach. And so we have chapter 12, which is the first group of laws presented to the nation, people of Israel, to the descendants of Yaakov Avinu, to B'nai Israel. This is the first group of laws. But what I want to draw our attention to is not chapter 12 itself, but the frame around chapter 12. So let me, if you notice, because I want to bring this to your attention, if you're not familiar with it, the website I'm using was developed by Rabbi and Rabbanit Hillel and Ni'iman Novetsky. It's called alhatorah.org. It is fantastic. It is a online mikro kedolot. It has mishnayot. It has shas. It has shulchan aruch. Here's the mikro kedolot on that one pasuk. Right? You see Rashi, Rashbam, Ibn Ezra. If it has English, it's not dissimilar. And in fact, it uses the resources of Sepharia in part to help populate its material. But it has the layout of a mikro kedolot, which for us, those of us used to a rabbinic Bible, it really is a great thing. Okay, commercial break is over. We're going back to the frame, the narrative frame of this set of laws. So I'm going to go up to the 11th chapter of Sefer Shemot. We know the drill. The children of Israel had been enslaved in Egypt for a very long time, and they cry out to God, and finally God takes notice of him, and he raises up a redeemer who is none other than Moses, and Moshe Rabbeinu goes to Pharaoh and says, I speak on behalf of God, let my people go. And Pharaoh says, as the children's song goes, no, 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 I will not let them go, or something akin to that in biblical Hebrew. Well, what does God do? God brings nega achar nega. He brings plague after plagues, makah achar makah. And God smites the Egyptian people and hardens Pharaoh's heart. And first Pharaoh hardens his own heart, then God hardens his heart. And Pharaoh won't let him go. And through great signs and wonders, we have this escalation building in the narrative. It's very dramatic. And finally, we come after nine plagues to the 10th plague, the plague to end all plagues. It is a very scary plague. It is the death of the firstborn. We know this well from our constant rehearsal of this at our Pesach Seders, apart from our hopefully ongoing study of the Book of Shmos every year. Vayomer Hashem el Moshe. There at the very beginning of chapter 11, God says to Moshe, Od nega achad avi al parov al mitzrayim. I will bring one more plague on Pharaoh and on Egypt. Achareichen yishalach et chamizeh. Afterwards, God will send you from this. Kishalcho kalag gareshi gareshi et chamizeh. He will send you out of this, out. It shall be complete. He shall surely you drive you out from this, place. And, you should ask gold and silver. And God, Vayomer Moshe, and Moshe then says and declares, Ko amar Hashem, thus says the Lord God, Techatzot halayla, about midnight, ani yotze betoch Mitzrayim, I myself will go out through Egypt, umei kol b'chor b'eretz Mitzrayim, and every firstborn of Egypt shall die. Mi b'chor paro ayoshev al kiso ad b'chor hashivcha asher achara rechayim b'chol b'chor b'ema. From the firstborn of Pharaoh to the firstborn of the maidservant who is behind the mill, and even the animals, their firstborn shall die. Okay? This is a very scary warning. Last chance. Right? And Pharaoh says, you will never see my face again. Get out. Now, what would we expect at this moment when Moses warns Pharaoh of the 10th plague and Pharaoh says, no, 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 I will not let them go? How would we expect the narrative to proceed? Well, we would expect it to proceed just like in the movies, my friends. If you've ever seen Cecil B. DeMille's The Ten Commandments, what happens after Moses says, I will bring one more plague upon you? And Pharaoh says, no, no, no. What happens? The green mist or something descends upon Egypt and all of the firstborn die. We would expect the story at its most climactic moment to reach its apogee for the story to continue and unfold, because we are in the thick of the narrative. And indeed, at some point, that story does continue. But what happens is the guy in the room where the reel of the film is attached to the projector stops the projector, turns on the light, goes on a coffee break, sends in the Magid Shir, the instructor, and instead of continuing with the most climactic scene, we continue with chapter 12, which is the giving of mitzvah to the children of Israel. And it's only after we continue through chapter 12 and we receive all of these mitzvot, 28 full verses later, in the 29th pasuk, Vayihi b'chatzi alayla, at midnight, Vashem hikakol b'chor b'eretz Mitzrayim. God smote every firstborn of Egypt. In other words, Rashi, in his first comment on the Torah, says, why did God interrupt law with narrative? And when we are reading Sefer Shmot, Parshat Bo, we could say, why does the Torah interrupt narrative with mitzvah, with law? It's not good form. If you're in narrative, especially at the most climactic moment, don't shut off the movie. Keep it going. I want to see how it ends. And yet, timeout is called, and we have chapter 11, chapter 12, the introduction of mitzvah. So the Torah interrupts narrative with mitzvah, and per Rashi's question, interrupts mitzvah with narrative. Why? What is the relationship and the interconnection between halacha and agada? Now, I would like to bring this a tiny bit further, and then I'm going to get to some interactive questions. Okay? I want to come to Parshat Mishpatim. Parshat Mishpatim is chapter 20 to chapter 23, verse 33. So three very long prakim of laws, all different types of laws, civil law, a little criminal law, and ritual law. But before we get to that, before we get to Parshat Mishpatim, I need to go up. Okay. Here we are in Parshat Yitro. Here we are in Parshat Yitro. And all of chapter 19, Perek Yutet, in Parshat Yitro, describes the buildup to Ma'amad Har Sinai and Matan Torah, the giving of the Ten Commandments, to Revelation. Just rushing through it, right? They traveled from Rephidim. That's where Amalek attacked them. They came to the wilderness of Sinai and camped in the wilderness. And famously, Vayichan Sham Yisrael Neged Ahar. And when Israel encamped against the mountain, and it switches from the plural to the single, which led Rashi to say, Ki ish echad v'lev echad, like one person they encamped, united in purpose with a common heart, right? And God, Moshe goes up to God, and God calls unto him, and he says, thus you shall speak, Levet Yaakov v'tagid levnei Israel. And if you remember, the rabbis also say, Beit Yaakov are the women, Bnei Israel are the men. That's why we call Beis Yaakov schools, Beis Yaakov, after the Beis Yaakov, and right, Atemri tem asher et asher asher asitim l'mitraim. You saw everything I did in Egypt, how I bore you on wings of eagles and brought you to me. And now you shall hear my voice and hearken to my covenant, and you shall be an am segulali, a segula mikol ha'amim, a treasured possession from all the peoples, ki li kol ha'aretz, for all the earth is mine. Batem tiuli mamlechet kohanim begoy kadosh, you shall be for me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation, sublime oratory. Ela dvarim asher tedaber el bnei Israel, and these are the words that you should speak to Israel. And we have the preparation, the narrative describing the preparation for the 3 days before Matan Torah, and Moshe going up the mountain and down the mountain. And on the third day in the morning, there's thunder and there's lightning and a heavy cloud on the mountain. And the kol shofar chazak ma'od ve'chared kol am asher b'chaneh, and everyone's trembling. And we have a very thick description, of Ma'amad Har Sinai, of the encampment and the standing of the children of Israel at Har Sinai, waiting to receive the revelation of the Torah. And that's chapter 19. So then we go to chapter 20. And what is chapter 20? Starting in the first pasuk, we have law, Va'aserta Dibrot, the 10 utterances, which has religious law and civil law and criminal law all together on the two. And then when we get past the 10th commandment, Lo tachmo, thou shalt not covet, we're back at verse 14. V'chol ha'am ro'im et ha'kolot v'et ha'lepidim. And we're back to narrative. And then it continues in the narrative of Revelation from all the way through verse 18. Vayamod ha'ame rachok, Moshe nigash el ha'rafel, and the people stood at a distance, and Moshe approached the thick darkness where God was. And then we have law again. Vayomer Hashem el Moshe, kotum ha'al b'nei Yisrael. Atem ritem kimin ha'shamam dibirti imachem. You have seen that I'm speaking you from heaven, and then it goes through a bunch of rules. Lo tasuniti Elohei kesef, don't make other gods out of silver, out of gold, don't make an earthen altar you should make for me, and you'll make offerings on it. And it introduces some ritual law. And then we go to chapter 21. And for the next three chapters, we have our Parsha, Parsha Mishpatim. And that carries us all the way forth until we get to chapter 24. Ve'el Moshe Amar Alei El Hashem Ata Ve'aron Nadav Ve'aviv V'shibim Mizikne Yisrael V'shtachavita Me'rachok. Again, the narrative of Revelation. So I'm going to now share the screen with you. And it goes something like this, right? We have 19 Revelation. 20, the first 14 psukim Aseres HaDibros. Then we have Revelation, a narrative. Then we have Parshat Mishpatim. Then we have, again, a closing episode of a narrative of Revelation. Revelation, law, revelation. And by revelation, again, I mean a narrative of revelation. Why create this narrative and law sandwich to present the Torah? What do you make of that? What is the purpose of bringing together law and narrative in this way? Why unfold it in this way? Why interrupt law with narrative, and why interrupt narrative with law? Why does the Torah do this? If the Torah is a book of mitzvot, give me a code, or at least a repository of legal opinion. And if the Torah is a book of narrative, then why have these timeouts and digressions to give me codes of law? Okay, I need to rest my voice and I need to hear from you. So what do you think? Anyone have any thoughts? What is the relationship of halacha, agadah, chok, the sipur, nomos, the narrative, law and story? What is their relationship, and why does the Torah present it as it does in order to convey this idea?
Maybe the Torah is echoing the Shas. The Gemara follows that paradigm. Maybe the Torah follows the Shas.
Wonderful. Is that you speaking, Eric?
No, it's Gershon Hepner.
Oh, Gershon. Okay, so thank you. Gershon, let me just, with your permission, just slightly edit your comments. You're making the observation that the Torah Sheba'al Peh does the same thing. From the Mishnah to the Gemara, there is a presentation of law and narrative often together. There are numerous instances in the Mishnah where, from the very first Mishnah in Masechet Brachot, of Maaseh, right, with the sons of Rabban Gamliel, there are numerous instances in the Mishnah where narrative attends halacha, whether it be ritual or some other. And even more so in the Gemara do we have Agadah and halacha that are conjoined together. So is the Torah following the Talmud, or is the Talmud following the Torah? Or are they two sides of the same coin? Because at some fundamental level, both the Torah Shebichtav and the Torah Shebaal Peh were given at Har Sinai. It's excellent. Are you okay with my, before Chaim, we get to you, before you, Gershon, was my edit okay?
I have an idea, too.
Fantastic answer.
Okay.
You must have read my book.
Okay.
I have an idea, too.
Yeah, who's speaking?
Eric.
I wanted to speak, but somebody else ahead of me.
Okay. Well, okay, I'm going to call on Eric, and then Zahav, and then Annie, and then Chaim.
Let's see the image of the talit, which is a woven cloth of warp and woof, and I see the interleaving of these to say you can't make a talit without weaving, and you can't put these things together, halacha and narrative, separately. They have to be woven together, or you don't have a piece of cloth.
So that's a beautiful metaphor. That's a beautiful metaphor to say that halacha and agadah go together like the warp and woof of a woven fabric.
Rabbi?
Oh, Chaim, go ahead, and then...
Okay, maybe it is either a shortcoming of a human being to accept too much halachot or too much commands. That's the reason there is some breakage in between, or maybe too easy it for us to understand it and accept it.
Okay, so let me start with the second comment of Chaim, that Agadah makes the halacha easier to swallow. It softens it. It makes it more human. It allows it. Okay, the first part, which you said, which was we're kind of reading the halachot in the Torah. We get bored. We can't concentrate, so we need some agadah to keep our attention.
No, opposite.
Okay, what were you saying?
It's to be able to concentrate for a long time. We can't concentrate for a long time. It's not too easy. Just because of our shortcoming, we cannot accept too many details or too much information at once. That's it. It's not boring. It's not the boring point.
Okay.
It's the high level that we need to focus and concentrate, and we cannot.
Okay. No, I accept that, right? We have you. The expression in the Rishonim. I think it goes back to rabbinic literature, Dibra HaTorah Bilshom B'nei Adam, that the Torah speaks in human language, but the Torah speaks also in ways that humans best learn. And halacha and agadah together is pedagogically sound. Okay. Stop.
Pardon me, Rabbi. Pardon me. Yeah. I point that you don't have a time limit for studying the Torah, whether you're studying this kind or that kind of presentation. You don't have to do it in an instant.
So, yes, I'm still working on it, and I'm 54 years old, so it's
and you should go for many, many more.
Thank you. Zahab and Annie, you've been waiting patiently. So Zahab first, and then Annie, and then I'll get to the other hands thereof.
Okay, mine is a takeoff a little bit on Chaim's, but that revelation, if you're trying to say the revelation is what's our purpose in the world and how do we live a good life and what's it all about, is too intense for people to really focus on too long. So you need to be distracted or focus on minutiae like halachot. So that's why we focus on all these things, because the big picture is just too difficult all the time to focus on.
Okay.
The problem with that is we end up as Jews with these volumes of books on halachot, and we miss the big picture. And an example of that would be since we're doing Mishpatim, the whole machloket between Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai about what happens when you free, when you have free a Hebrew slave. So the, as far as I understand it, the Beit Hillel part said, all right, he'll be a free man half the time and a slave half the time. And Beit Shammai pointed out, this puts him in an untenable position about not being able to marry, et cetera, et cetera. So there, Beit Shammai focused on what does the overall thing mean, and the Beit Hillel focused on the minutiae and got it wrong.
Okay, great. I love both comments. One is the reiteration that pedagogically it is more effective to teach with both story and law. And the second point, if I heard you correctly, is very powerful, which is that Agadah and Halakha give us both a macroscopic and a microscopic view, the big picture and the small picture, the forest and the trees. Annie, what say you?
I'm seeing it from another lens, I think. I'm seeing as the relationship between Hashem, the Jewish people, and the laws being a living, breathing relationship. That's why we're still trying to figure it out. And in a living, breathing relationship, you have the narrative. You have the life of the people interspersed with the laws of the people that Hashem has given us and how we go about our life, living and doing our own narrative with the law.
That's so beautiful and poetic, the life and the law of the people. Agadah reflects life and living, and law is kind of static and frozen, or at least it could be perceived that way, at least at first. Beautiful. Professor Kaplan, you're muted, my dear teacher. I've never studied with you in person, but I've read your book, so I'm going to call you Alufim Yuadi.
Okay. Yeah, I'm unmuted now. Okay. Yeah, I'd like to come back to Shmot. It seems to me there's a difference between the relationship of narrative and law in Exodus 11 and 12, and then in terms of Mishpatim, the Ten Commandments. That is, you can't really jump from 11 to 13, because chapter 11 is about the plague of the firstborn. But if Israel won't observe the Passover, won't put the blood on the doorpost, then they'll be killed. So there's a very integral relationship there between the law and the narrative. And actually, all of the laws there are connected with Yetziat Mitzrayim. So it's not really, I don't see this as an interruption. I see it as the laws being necessitated by the narrative. With reference to the Ten Commandments and the Mishpatim, there I think the narrative serves as a frame in order to explain what the basis of the authority of the law is, namely God's. Then the law, and at that point, the law has its own goal. I mean, the law is a law which is a covenant, but you have to have the frame to explain what the basis of authority is, that the people accepted it. At Revelation, they said, Naseh or Naseh.
Beautiful.
Vinishma.
Beautiful. So let me again reiterate your points to make sure I understood them. I'm going
sure.
to stop it in a second. So, and I'm going to mute you only because there's some background information sound going on there. Okay. So what I heard from Professor Kaplan is that the purpose of the frame, the sandwich, so to speak, of revelation and narrative revelation. And then law in Parshat Mishpatim and the Ten Commandments before, and it continues through chapter 24, is really to credit HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Hashem, as the law, the source of law, which is different, by the way, than other conceptions of law in the ancient Near East, where it was either the ruler who was the source of law or something like that. So I think that is 100% true. Right. The narrative frame there gives the authority and the legitimacy and also the accountability that we have under the law by framing it as a revelation. And it does it very effectively because the law doesn't stand on its own, but it's woven in this revelation. And there may be other valences of meaning. Professor Kaplan and I largely agree, but might slightly disagree about chapter 12 and its purpose. On the one hand, it's absolutely right that the laws are not divorced completely systematically from the 10th plague, and that to avert disaster for the Israelites themselves, they're going to have to abide by these mitzvot that they're given. And yet there are more mitzvot that are given regarding the 10 commandments, and at least through the rabbinic interpretation of HaChodesh HaZeh Lachem, the establishment of the Jewish calendar, and some of us may be aware of Rabbi Soloveitchik's Torah on this, about time awareness as the first taste of internal freedom after the experience of slavery. But my point is the Torah could have accomplished that in a different way, but instead it has this layering of law and narrative that we find not only in these cases, but in other cases as well. Sima, and then Greg, and then we're going to move on.
I was just thinking that the Torah as a book of laws is given to a nation, and until we learn about the development of the nation, it wouldn't make much sense to give laws. So the whole book of Bereishit and the first few chapters of Shemot give us a sense of what it means to be a nation, and all the lessons we learned from the Avot and Imahot and just from Yitziat Mitzrayim and the Makot. I would venture to say that is what we need as a nation and as individuals in order to be able to abide by the laws with any meaning, in order to have a relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And maybe each narrative between each bread of the sandwich gives us more more meaning in order to go further to the next set of laws.
Yes.
Maybe there's something that we're learning from each set of each narrative, that as a nation and as individuals, in order to be able to abide by those laws with any meaning.
Beautiful, beautiful. There was a beautiful explication, Sima. What helps us cohere as a people? Sacred. Now, a shared sacred is not that if we all go over 65 miles per hour or whatever the equivalent of kilometers in Canada, if we all speed on the highway, that we're going to get a ticket. That's not what gives us a shared sacred, the fact that we're all subject to the same laws and their consequences. What gives us a shared sacred, right, is what the laws are trying to accomplish, right? Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness here on this side of the border. I'm sure the Canadians have their equivalent on the other side of the border. And for the people of Israel, like I quoted, to be a Am Segula, treasured people by God, a Mamlechet Kohanim, a kingdom of priests, in the words of the prophet, Or LaGoyim, a light unto the nations, right, to be an Am Kadosh, a holy people, right? This is the telos, the purpose of our relationship of the laws. It's not just about the rules, right? There's a larger frame here, and giving us a shared origin story, a shared history of having ethical expectations. All of this helps frame the purpose of the law. Excellent. My dear old friend, Greg, it is wonderful to see you. And I see Susan's on I'm glad you're building up the number of screens that are attending the class, multiple screens.
Thank you very much. And I will assure you that she's just in the next room over and not anywhere else. I was going to keep silent, but I would say, I would just for the sake of the discussion, and I very much look forward to hear your idea, is to point out that probably the most simple and obvious explanation would be that the reason why the law interspersed was narrative is because it was given within that narrative. That is the whole presentation is within the some sort of a historical narrative. And if the laws are given at that point, then they would be inserted into the narrative. Now, that is not necessarily the idea that I would subscribe to, but I would say that
I accept that, and that certainly makes a lot of sense for the Torah. It doesn't explain the Talmud's relationship of law and narrative, and it doesn't explain every episode of law and narrative.
Absolutely.
There is absolutely foundational truth to what you are saying. That being the case, I want to go back to Rashi's first comment on the Torah, which is we don't have the wisdom of a Kadosh Baruch Hu, but if we were tasked by our supervisor, employer, the great employer above to write up, right, a Torah for the people of Israel, and at the core of the Torah are 613 mitzvot, I might have written a Sefer Achinuch. I might have written a Sefer HaMitzvot, just a list of 613 mitzvot. I might have written, like Maimonides did, a Mishnah Torah that rehearses all of the laws in systematic, granular fashion and not rooting it in some narrative frame. So you are 100% correct, Greg. But HaKadosh Baruch Hu chose as our Holy Torah a unique type of category of holy literature.
Genre.
Genre, which is neither narrative nor law, but intermixing of both.
Exactly. But I think your proposition, what I briefly just want to conclude, is your proposition implies is that there's a deviation from this principle of historicity of the whole narrative and the law being given. So I think it begs the question is,
yeah,
if the text is rearranged along lines other than historical, what is the pattern that it is trying to conform to? So I just wanted to kind of point that out.
Yeah, no, and your point is well taken. Absolutely. Okay. I would like to press forward a tiny bit with your permission. So I'm going to just rearrange my screen for a second. And I'm going to share my screen. Okay. I when I was a student at Yeshiva University, I once attended a talk by my dear late teacher and mentor, Rabbi Dr. Norman Lamb, the late great president and chancellor of Yeshiva University. And the topic was Halacha and Agadah, our topic of law and narrative. With your permission, I apologize. There's some ambient noise, so I'm just going to mute everyone. There we go. Okay. So Rabbi Lamb wanted to take issue with the great Hebrew poet Chaim Nachman Bialik. Chaim Nachman Bialik wrote an essay called Halacha and Agadah in 1917. This is before he left Odessa. It was after his time in Volozhin as a student in the yeshiva, before he left Odessa for Tel Aviv. And he wrote Halacha v'Agadah. Here is, I have three different translations of it. I was so taken it up. This was the one from 1923 by Julius Siegel. This is the one the year 2000, a different one. And then I have another one. Nope, that's not the one. This one, this is an earlier one, 1944 by commentary. It is a well-translated and trod, they're all different translations, essay. So let me find this one. This is how it begins. It's very poetic, so I wanted to share it with you. You may or may not be familiar with it. Halacha wears a frown, Agadah a smile. The one is pedantic, severe, unbending, all justice. The other is accommodating, lenient, pliable, all mercy. The one commands and knows no halfway house. Her yea is yea, her nay is nay. The other advises, takes account of human limitations. She admits something between yea and nay. The one is concerned with the shell, the other the body, with actions. The other with the kernel, with the soul, with intentions. On one side there is petrified observance, duty, subjection. On the other, perpetual rejuvenation, liberty, free volition. Turn from the sphere of life to that of literature, and there are further points of contrast. On the one side is dryness of prose, a formal and heavy style, a gray and monochrome diction. Reason is sovereign. On the other side is the sap of poetry, a style of full of life and variety. A diction all ablaze with color. Emotion is sovereign. Right. So he builds these polarities between halacha and agadah. Halacha wears a frown. Don't do that. You must do that. Agadah, a smile. Let me tell you a story of someone who was supposed to do something, but didn't quite do it. And this is how it turned out. And it was so complex. Right there. That's law and narrative. Now, Rabbi Lamb critiqued this. And he felt that one could argue the opposite. He said that halachas much more kind and easier than Agadah. Why is that? Well, because with halacha, you know exactly where you stand. Let me give a elementary example. It's Pesach, and you have to eat matzah. You have to drink wine. Halacha says, this is the amount of wine that you need to drink. This is the amount of matzah that you would need to eat. When you eat the matzah, lean to the left, right? This is the basic of the Passover story that you have to tell. This is the bare minimum. But Agadah is all aspiration. It's Devarim She'ein Lahem Shiur. Let me show you, for those who are doing the Daf Yomi of Yerushalmi, we're making a Siyum on Masechet Brachot. And we're going to start Masechet Peah. Some of you may recognize the first Mishnah of Peah because it's part of our Tefillah. Eilu Devarim She'ein Lahem Shiur. These are the matters that have no measure. So Rabbi Lamb asked us, students of Yeshiva University, which is harder to do? Things that have no measure or things that have a measure? Things that don't have a measure, it's true that you could do the bare minimum, but it's also true that you've never achieved the maximum because they have no measure. You'll never say, Yatsati, I fulfilled the obligation, because there's no measure. Whereas when something has a measure, then you fulfilled it. You know exactly where you stand. Halacha is kinder because you know what your responsibility is. Agadah is aspirational. You always fail the goal. You never are sufficient to it. That was Rabbi Lamb's critique. So let me get back to I'm Nachman Bialik. Now, you might think that as a Zionist and as a poet and as an author, he would then, you know, champion Agadah and diminish Halacha. But he actually says quite the opposite. And it's quite a magnificent essay. First of all, he says, much of the time in the Halacha, there is an implicit Agadah. Take, for example, the 16th chapter of Masechet Shabbat, he says. He quotes from the Tosefta. We could look. It's the same thing in the Mishnah, right? What does the Mishnah say? Hol Kitvei Kodesh. Here, I'm going to show you the Mishnah. I brought it up here. Kol Kitvei HaKodesh. All of the sacred writings, if there's a fire, you're allowed to move them on the Shabbat. Matzilin otam mipnei adleka. You move them in the light of a fire. Ben shekarim bahen, ben she'en karim bahen. Whether you read them on the Shabbat or whether they're just books on your shelf or on the scroll shelf, right? The afal pish ktuvim b'chol ashon, and says the Mishnah, even if they're written in all languages, to unin geniza, they need to be put in. They need to be put in the geniza. Okay. Now, what the Mishnah doesn't reveal is exactly what does it mean, whether you read them or not read them, whether they're in Hebrew or another language. So the Tosefta makes it more clear. Any of the holy writings may be saved from fire on Shabbat. This applies to a translation in Aramaic or any other language, Coptic, Medic, Elamic, Greek. But Rabbi Yosef says that translations may not be saved. Can anyone guess what the debate between the Tanakhama, the first authority and teacher, is, and Rabbi Yossi, who says, don't save vernacular translations of the Hebrew Bible on Shabbat when there's a fire? And the Tanakhama says, of course you could save them. What is being debated here? Let me frame this another way. Some of you may know that the Greek translation of the Hebrew Bible is narrated in Masechet Megillah and other places, was a big miracle. Ptolemy, the Egyptian Greek ruler of the domain of Egypt, took 70 Jewish scholars, put them in 70 different cubicles on an island in the middle of the Nile, and said, translate the Torah into Greek. And miracle of miracles, they all translated the work independently and came out with the exact same translation. Okay, the exact same translation. Although my academic friends tell me that, you know what, it would have been an even bigger miracle if all 70 scholars were in the same room and agreed on a common translation. That would have been even been a bigger miracle.
Rabbi.
The miracle was. Yeah.
The translation was the same. However, a translation is an explanation. And that makes it a bigger miracle, the fact the explanation was the same. You cannot translate an idea or a concept from language to language. It doesn't matter what language, and it doesn't matter how good you are in the languages. It's impossible specifically with Hebrew.
100%. There are native ambiguities within the language, and so every act of translation is an act of interpretation and explanation. And it happens to be that the Targum Shivim or the LXX or the Septuagint is a pretty expansive translation. So it has interpolations of ideas in it as well. And that was the miracle. So by saying it's a miracle, what are you saying? You're saying that the Greek translation actually has divine blessing and sanction, that it should be considered sacred. Now,
you cannot do that. You can't. I don't agree with that. Just because the miracle was done, that all the people, the 70 people, were able to explain it in the same way, it does not give it that strength to say it, Davar Kadosh, or Davar Big Dusha.
Okay, we could disagree about that. But there's another tradition as well that says that the sages declared a fast day, Shivasar B'Tammuz, or they added it to the reason for, not Shivasar, Asar B'Tevet. They added it to the reason for Asar B'Tevet. Why do we fast on Asar B'Tevet? One of the reasons is because it was Bo Bayom on that day that the Torah was translated into Greek. So is it a good thing or a bad thing? Well, we know that Jews did not speak Hebrew and Bayit Sheni. They spoke Aramaic and they spoke other languages. So is translating something in a frum translation, right? Is that good for the Jewish people? Or is it a gateway? You'll forgive me. I have 8 minutes left and I apologize. Okay. So you'll forgive me, everyone. I'm glad that you're so eager to share your comments. You'll forgive me. Please continue these conversations at your Shabbos table. Okay, my dear friends. So is it a good thing or is it a bad thing? So Chaim Nachman Bialik has a beautiful interpretation of this Tosefta in the Mishnah. The Tanakhama thinks that translating it is a good thing. People know more Torah and the language they understand. And Rabbi Yossi thinks that it's the road to assimilation, the road to acculturation. Not only that, but it lowers the threshold in the bar. You don't have to learn Hebrew. All you have to do is buy the translation. It's enough. And so, as a Zionist and a Hebraist, Chaim Nachman Bialik is interpreting it that way. Now, he ends the essay, and then I want to return to the Parsha. He ends the essay by saying, the value of Agadah is ultimately that it issues in Halakha. Right? He actually laments people who say, oh, I'll accept the Agadah, I'll accept the poetry and the lyricism and the mythos and the stories of the Jewish people, but Halakha, no, I don't want to do that. He said, a Halakha without Agadah is not a living tradition, and an Agadah without a Halakha has no sense of duty. The value of Agadah is that it issues in Halakha. Agadah that does not bring Halakha in its train is ineffective, it's useless. But where is duty? Whence can it come? On what is it to live? On Agadah? But Agadah is by its very nature the embodiment of its volition. It admits something between yea and nay. But rather, right, what is the articulation of the values and the ethos conveyed through our stories, through our Agadah, through our maxims and homilies and narratives? That is instantiated and encompassed and ensconced in the Halakha. The Agadah gives us perspective on what the Halakha is supposed to accomplish, and the Halakha gives articulation in word and in action to the aspiration of the Agadah, to an instantiation of its values. Now, I want to end in the few minutes that I have left by going back to Parshat Mishpatim. Let me get there. You'll forgive me. Where did I go? Parshat Mishpatim. Okay, here we go. I want to go up. Okay, I want to focus, and this is a teaser because we don't have enough time to study this, unfortunately, in depth. But many of you know that in our parsha we have what is known in Latin as lex Talionis, the law of Talion, T-A-L-I-O-N, which is midak neged midak, quid pro quo, and articulated in Hebrew, ayin tachat ayin, shein tachat shein. Where did I lose it? It's 21. It's chapter 21. There we go. Here. Okay. Ayin tachat ayin, shein tachat shein. I'm not sharing the screen. That's why you're not seeing it. How long have I not been sharing the screen? Okay. There we go. I'm sorry. Okay. Ayin tachat ayin, shein tachat shein, yad tachat yad, regel tachat ragel. An eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, a hand for a hand, a leg for a leg. Chazal tell us, don't take it literally. It means the may ayin, the monetary value of an eye for an eye. But isn't an eye priceless? Who would sell their eye? I wouldn't give up my vision for some money. But no, but the truth is that we have to apply valuations to these things. That's what happens in life. Not that we would sell an eye, but God forbid, if someone injures an eye, you have to be able to evaluate it. Otherwise, there's no equity. There's no way to create a system of justice. Okay, but that's not what I'm interested in. What I want to ask is, right, the casuistic presentation of law. Casuistic is the fancy word for case law. B'chiyanatsu anashim, when two men fight. B'nakfu isha haran, they hit a pregnant woman, a bystander. They're intending to punch. But instead of punching each other, they punch a pregnant woman, chas v'shalom. B'yatsu yiladeha, and she miscarries. V'lo yiaso, but she doesn't die, but she miscarries. Anoshi anesh kashir yashita la bal ha'isha v'natam b'flilim, then he shall surely be punished as the husband imposes upon him, and he shall give according to the judges. V'imasonia, but if someone dies, v'natata nefesh tachat nefesh, then you give a life for a life, and then it goes into the law of Talion, ayin tachat ayin, an eye for an eye. Is this casuistic presentation of law narrative or law, both or neither? No, I'm not opening that up for discussion because we have 3 minutes left. But think about it. On the one hand, it's telling a story. And in fact, we want to know more about this story. What were they fighting about? right? We want to know more about this story. But on the other hand, it's casuistic law. It's case law. It's presented as a case. But what's interesting about the law of Talion, of Ayin Tachat Ayin, it appears 3 times in the Torah. Once here in Parshat Mishpatim, this week's Parsha, once in Sefer Devarim in chapter 19. And when we look there, once again, in that case, there's a casuistic presentation before that as well. The casuistic presentation there is conspiring witnesses. There's a trial, someone standing trial, and witnesses conspire and share false testimony in order to not only indict, but to find guilty the accused. And it's in that context we then have the law lex, the law of Talion. And then the third case is even more challenging. It's the case of the blasphemer. Many of you know that Sefer Vayikra is a book of law, and it only has two short narratives. Sefer Breshit is almost entirely a book of narrative. It may have Brit Milah and Gid Hanasha. Let's call those laws. Everything else is narrative. Sefer Shmot is the sandwich. Starts out as narrative, then moves into narrative and law, and back and forth till its end. Sefer Vayikra is all law except for two small narratives, the death of Nadav Aviu and then the case of the Mekalel, the blasphemer. Sefer Bamidbar is almost all narrative, and Sefer Devarim is a different order because it's Moshe's final orations. But his orations are narrating, and they introduce new law and rehearse law that had been already given. And so we have this intermixture of law and narrative. But when it comes to Talion, right, which is seen as kind of like a framework for the law, they're all introduced by laws. Now listen to this one. And an Israelite woman, and there was a son of an Israelite woman whose father was an Egyptian man, came within the camp of Israel, and there was a fight in the camp between this half Israelite, the son of the Israelite, and a full Israelite, an Ish Israeli. And then the half Israelite man, the son of the Israelite woman, blasphemes God, curses God. And they bring him to Moshe, and he doesn't know what to do. And they put him in jail, holding cell, until Moshe inquires what to ask of God. And then God gives the law of the blasphemer, which is a capital crime. And then God rehearses the ish ki akeh kol nefesh adam mot yumat, and goes through the law of Talion, and then repeats something here that is also in our parsha: mishpach echad yelachem kager kezrach yeh, one law for you, for the stranger, and for the citizen alike. I am the Lord your God, and the children of Israel did as God had commanded. So what's the reason I'm showing you this is, even within the legal sections, there are presentations not only of apodictic law, thou shalt not, right, the real dry codification of law, but framing it in a human encounter. Now, I want to conclude, it's 9:31, give me 30 more seconds. I want to conclude. There was a wonderful article on this topic. There are many wonderful articles. A lot of people think about law and narrative. There's a wonderful article by Moshe Halbertal of Hebrew University, a professor, and I think he's at NYU Law School as well. He wrote a book for a feshrift in honor of the great Professor Aviezer Ravitsky, Alav HaShalom, Al Saf HaSlicha Al Chok V'Sipur B'Talmud. And that was translated in a very short article that's available online at the Jewish Review of Books, At the Threshold of Forgiveness, A Study of Law and Narrative in the Talmud. And Moshe Halbertal uses the laws of tshuva to compare and contrast how they're expressed in law and how they're expressed in the Talmudic narratives about forgiveness. And this is what he writes in his final paragraph. In Moses Maimonides' great medieval codification of the laws of repentance in the Mishneh Torah, the rules of requesting forgiveness are further formalized. While the stories of Rabbi Yirmiyahu and Rabbi Abba and Rabbi Zeir and Rabbi Huna and Rav and the butcher are left aside, the Rambam cuts out all of the Agadah. Separating law and narrative in that way removes a layer of meaning and flattens our understanding of the process of reconciliation. The Talmud's frequent joining of the two genres embodies a profound expression of humility, for the law thereby acknowledges its own limits. This is especially true in the case of forgiveness, which is part of the complex and delicate fabric of interpersonal relationships. Let me put this in my own words. Life is messy. Life is complex. Life is multivalence. And that's, I'm only talking about myself. Put me or someone else in engagement with another person or with a group of people or groups of people with other groups of people or nations with nations. We, right, have a multiplicatory power, even an exponential power of complexity, nuance, and messiness, right? The law is, very cut and dry. How do you fit the squareness of the law in the messiness of life? We have to, because that's what it means to build a good society and to live as a holy people and a light into the nations and am mamlechet kohanim begoy kadosh. That's what it means to be that role modeling nation with a Torah. But what that requires of us is that the Torah that we study with our full kavanah of intentionality has two sides of the same coin, a warp and a woof, two aspects of the same woven fabric. It has agadah and it has halakha. It has the emotion and the messiness of human life, the context, and then it has the text of the law, which itself is aspirational. In some ways, more than the Agadah, as I said before, the Agadah is aspirational. In some ways, the law is aspirational because we're always trying to live a life by the law, even when we live a life in the messiness of the Agadah. But the good news is, and the powerful lesson of our parsha and of our Torah Shebichtav and our Torah Shebal Peh is by the Torah and the divine wisdom by combining halacha and agadah, not as separate pieces, but as woven together, and the Torah Shebal Peh doing the same thing, gives us permission and license to realize that our endeavors as well, our hishtadlut, is that we aspire to the halachic observance, even in the messiness of the agadah of our lives. And the two of them go together pedagogically, contextually and textually, and in terms of their partnership in achieving the ultimate goals of the Torah, which is to fashion us into a holy role modeling nation. Thank you for studying with me, and I'll see you sometime next year.
Thank you. You can
unshare. You.
Yeah, there you go. Thank you, Rev Benji. Yeshikoch, we look forward to learning with you in the future, and thank you, everybody. Tomorrow morning, 9:30, my ongoing shiur on the Siddur, we're the Birchat Kriyat Shema. Sunday morning, of course, Rabbi Liebtag will start off the week. I think we have 12 or 13 classes next week, and as I mentioned, some of the other classes. Monday, Shuli Mishkan's beginning a new series. So that's our new series for next week. That will be at 1:15 p.m., right after Rachel Danziger's shiur at 12, and that'll be followed by Shuli at 1:15. Next week, the Parsha shiur is going to be given by Lior Moskowitz. She spoke last year, young Tamid HaChachama. So we look forward to learning with you. And always please invite a friend, and everybody have a Shabbat Shalom. Be well. Rabbi Benji, thank you very much. And do you have a link to the article, or is it?
I could send you a link to it.
Albertel article, yeah. And yeah, I think Lauren Captain pointed out, I'm glad to hear Dr. Ravetsky is still alive. I know he was severely injured a number of years ago, but
I apologize for that misinformation, and I stand corrected, and I'm mortified that I made mistakes. So, Professor Kaplan, thank you for correcting me. And you will find wisdom in Professor Kaplan's other comments on the chat. They're worth looking at before you sign off, and I'll wish everyone a good Shabbos.
Okay, thank you.
Shabbat shalom.
Shabbat shalom.
Shabbat shalom.